I'm thrilled to say that this series of Beyond the Bathroom is sponsored by Skin & Me, the subscription skincare service tailored to provide what your skin needs. Make sure to keep listening for a discount code you won't want to miss. That's for later in the episode. Now on with the show. Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I chat to my guests about their relationships with their own appearance. In Beyond the Bathroom, I attempt to get under the skin of my guests' beauty routines and rituals and hope to find out exactly what they see when they look in the mirror. How has their past affected the way they see themselves now? When did they look and feel their best? And how has their relationship with face and body shifted as life has ebbed and flowed? This week's guest is Alice Living, dancer, personal trainer, former clean eating guru turned straight-talking health advocate, who has unashamedly questioned and subverted her own and social media's attitude to fitness and wellness. Alice also has the highly dubious honour of being the only physical exercise account I have ever followed on Instagram. We met in person when we worked together on a project for Women's Aid, a charity painfully close to Alice's heart. And so please do consider this a trigger warning if this is a subject that may later cause you some distress. There will be details on where you can obtain expert support, information and help in the show notes. To her large Instagram and TikTok following, Alice has opened up about her acne, depression, anxiety, partner violence, and the almost universal improbability and indeed inadvisability of a washboard stomach. But today I'm interested in how Alice's constant and unabashed personal evolution has applied to her own appearance and how she has successfully redrawn clear and ethical boundaries between her outward appearance and her inward well-being. How does it feel to live in her skin and healthily changing body? How have mental health challenges lived alongside the constant external scrutiny of her appearance? Let's find out. Alice, welcome to Beyond the Bathroom. I am delighted to see you again.
Oh, Sally, that was so lovely. That was amazing. Yeah, I was actually thinking, oh, this girl sounds great. And it's me.
It's true. You are the only exercise account I've ever followed. I am useless at exercise. I'm just missing the gene that people have that gives me any sort of desire whatsoever to exercise beyond lots of walking about. I'm a busy walkie about person. And so I didn't come to you for the exercise. What kept me when I chanced across your account, whenever it was, a couple of years ago, is, and we'll talk about this a lot more, but I like people who are constantly changing their minds and questioning what they believe about the world and about themselves. So I find that such an attractive and healthy quality in somebody. And I want to really explore that, but I think it would be a good idea to talk about the context in which that sort of personal evolution of yours occurred, because I know you're passionate about changing your mind or acknowledging where your perspective has shifted.
Yeah.
So let's start as early back as we can remember. When do you think you first became aware of your own appearance?
Oh, such a good question. I think naturally, as one gets older, and I'm thinking back to like maybe age 9, 10, you go through that change of puberty, your body starts to change a little bit. And I remember being mildly conscious at probably that age of being maybe a little bit bigger than my friends. I went to an all-girls school, and I remember just, you know, like in a way that I probably never did before that point, spending time maybe looking at someone else next to me and saying, oh, she's a bit smaller than me. And why hasn't she got boobs yet? And oh, what's happening to my body? This feels really weird. And why is that not happening to her? And having that conscious kind of moment of looking at myself and thinking I'm a bit different. I wasn't, but in my head I was. And I think from that point, a lot of my relationship with my body was really an inherited thing from my mum. So my mum has had a really complex relationship with food and her body for her life. She was put in Weight Watchers age 12. She was told she was overweight. She then went on to have a really difficult eating disorder. She was 22 stone for majority of my childhood and very self-conscious. And, you know, I have really horrible memories of her being fat shamed publicly. So I think as a child, I'd grown up being really conscious that I never wanted to be like that. And then she went to the other extreme where she lost 10 stone, became a real kind of health fanatic. And my perception was then, well, to be that way, you've got to always be on a diet. I need to be constantly dieting because that's what a woman has to do to be socially acceptable, to be attractive, to be morally accepted, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I think that growing up as a teenager, from that moment where I was conscious of my body being a bit different, my mindset was always kind of conditioned to believe that smaller was better, and that if I was able to be in a small body, everything else would kind of be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I am so not alone. Almost every woman that I've spoken to has fallen foul of that way of thinking. But I think that mine was highly exacerbated by the industry that I went into. I trained as a professional dancer, and that was such a difficult environment to be in if you already enter that with body issues.
I really wanted to talk to you about this because I have known professional dancers, and I think there's so much focus in the media, rightly so, on the pressure that models are under, for example, to stay thin. But I've known lots of models and I've known several dancers, and I have never known anything like, or never seen anything like, the pressure that dancers, in particular ballet dancers, and I know you studied ballet, are under to be small and light and lithe. What did that look like for you?
Even things that I remember, which I was with a friend who I also trained with, and we were talking about it, Lucy, and I remember going to my audition for the college that I ended up going to and being weighed at my audition.
Yeah.
And even that was just, and I didn't even think of it at the time because it was almost just in my mindset that, of course you need to be small to be a dancer.
How old are you at this point?
So I was 19. So really difficult age. I'd already had quite a complex sort of time with food while I was at school because I'd gone through, and I know you referenced this in the introduction that you gave me, a really difficult relationship. I'd then taken that out it with food and control. So I was already not in a great place. But then going to my audition, being weighed, looking at all these other girls who are long and lean, and I'm 5 foot and I do not have legs up to my ears. Like, that's sadly the body that I've been given. So I remember being so acutely conscious of the fact that, like, if I was going to get into that school, I'd have to stay small because that's what they were after. And, you know, even now, there were people in my year who were who weren't the body that we all thought we needed. I'm going to put it that way, because I would never say they were bigger or anything. They were just them. But I remember the kind of jibes in class, the conversations that would be had after class. You know, you need to be put on a diet, you need to lose weight, you need to fit this, you need to do that. It was just a constant rhetoric that went on throughout the 3 years that I trained. And what bothers me is that it never felt abnormal to me. I never clocked that as being something that was wrong or bad or anything other than that's what you had to do to fit in and to get parts and to be successful as a dancer. And it's only now that I'm able to look back. And as you said, like, there's an evolution within yourself when you learn that things aren't actually what they're supposed to be like. And, oh, that's actually not right to say that and whatever, that I can look back now and say that was really disordered, and I know that the college has changed now, but I think the industry as a whole still has a long way to go.
But I think if little Alice had grown up seeing her mother fat shamed, it was probably a seamless transition, right? I mean, it's probably on some level you thought, well, that's what I deserve, that's what's right, I'm a girl, that's how it goes.
Absolutely. But even like when we talk about fat shaming, like, there was a moral superiority that my mum, and I've spoken to her about this now, which is why I know that she'll be happy for me to say this, but when she did lose her weight, I remember sitting at cafes and her being like, oh my God, look how big that woman is.
Yeah.
Now, if she said that in front of me, which she doesn't, because we've both talked about this stuff and talked about how important it is to never judge someone on their appearance, to not see fat as you know, a bad thing, that we would never do that now. But it was this constant stigma that I grew up with, that you can't be fat, you can be anything but be fat, because apparently that, you know, that was the worst thing that you could be in, because I'd grown up with this negative language and this fat shaming constantly. I just saw a very binary view of thin is good, fat is bad, and I just think that that's something that I now know to be so wrong and, you know, so backwards, but I just, that was what I was conditioned to believe.
It was absolutely the culture at the time, and continues to be in many ways.
Mm.
And so by the time you get to dance school, I suppose, as your mum is a work in progress, you're a work in progress, you get there and suddenly everyone's being weighed.
Mm.
that must have been kind of business as usual, right?
Completely. And I think that that continued, like I said, for the 3 years that I was there. I remember specific moments where I was in a dance class. I remember the teacher coming up to me and literally touching my stomach and being like, this needs to go, you know? And just like, I was probably less than a size 8.
Wow.
Like that's the reality. What happened to me there was in the first year of college, I actually lived so incredibly unhealthily in this desperate bid to be thin. And this is where like the sort of clean eating Alice, which I'm sure we'll go on to, came from, was to me, my first year was I lived Diet Coke.
Yeah.
I didn't eat much very at all during the week. I remember having like Rivita for dinner, which is terrible. And then on the weekends, binge eating and drinking and having this awful kind of binge restrict cycle, which I know so many people, particularly women, can relate to.
Absolutely.
That when I started clean eating Alice and there was vegetables on my plate and I was posting all these meals that were still not enough food, but in my head I was like, oh, this is the healthiest thing I could do. I think that's why I never quite understood what I was doing wasn't quite right for a long time until I grew up and learned more. Do you know what I mean? So to me, because of the contrast of where I'd come from, I was like, well, this is the healthiest I could ever be. But I think that I basically replaced one form of disordered eating with another and the cycle continued.
So as you went into that, exactly that process you're talking about on social media, there was one key difference, right, between that and being at dance school or seeing your mother ridiculed or whatever, the key difference being that suddenly people were telling you you were gorgeous, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So tell me about that external validation and how important was it for you and what was going on for you at the time?
Mm. First of all, I think the way that I rationalize it with women that I speak to now and when I talk about my experience is everybody, I don't care who you are, likes to be told that they look good. Like, it's a nice thing to hear. And particularly when you join an environment that's very new and very up and coming. This was the very early days of Instagram and social media. To suddenly have all these people being like, wow, you know, I want that. You look amazing. That's what I want to do. I very quickly realized that my body was currency and that it was currency for likes, for validation. And it was less about me. It was far less about me. Now I'm very forward with my personality, my opinions, my thoughts. Before, it was very, this is me, this is my body, and I'm going to let that do the talking. And I existed very much in a vacuum of kind of just wanting that validation of how I looked. And don't get me wrong, I think at the time I was like, this is amazing. And the difficult thing was, is that at college, I suddenly went to being like this girl that everyone wanted. And, you know, I got the main part in my second year musical. I remember teachers that had never even acknowledged me suddenly being like, she's got a six pack. She looks amazing. You know, like, it was just such a shift. And it just fed into this idea that what I was doing was the best thing I could have ever done for myself. And every woman that I have ever spoken to that has had a weight loss journey always recounts that period when they are probably not at their healthiest,
yes,
but they are at their thinnest and they are told they look amazing,
yes,
and they're getting comments that they look great. And that is why so many of us cling on to that body as being what we always want to get back to, because we remember, oh, that felt so good when people told me I look great. And if you move even a tiny bit away from that, it's, oh, you failed, because that was then the pinnacle. And if you come even a tiny bit away from that, oh, well, she couldn't maintain it. She's failed. And I think that for me, it was therefore a constant battle of wanting to cling on to this small body because of what it did for me in terms of that, you know, feeling of validation, of feeling somehow like I belonged in somewhere. We all search for belonging, don't we? Wherever we go, we want to feel as though we're part of something. And I had that. And I just think that it was a real moment for me of something's happening here for me. And I can't deny that. I just thought I'm onto something and I'm just going to ride this wave. And deep down there was restriction. There was a very difficult relationship with food. There was an inability to have balance. There was a lack of social life, but none of that mattered because on the surface, everything looked amazing.
And in hindsight, and maybe it's presumptuous of me, you will be able to tell me better, if that validation and that, Alice, you look thin and therefore you're great, was filling a hole. Mm. What, in hindsight, do you think should have been filling that hole, if not that?
I think if I had to say the hole that it filled, I think there was as we all do, there was a lot of baggage that I'd probably brought up from years of various different things happening. And look, I didn't have a traumatic childhood, no way. And I don't think that I had a terrible upbringing, but there were definitely things that I held on to. I think that I never thought that I was beautiful. I never thought that I was pretty. I never thought that I was that girl. At school, I'd found it quite difficult because I was sort of a little bit of an outsider to a very big girl group of popular girls. And I never really felt like I was the good looking one or the pretty one. So I think suddenly to have that feeling of being popular and being liked, I was like, oh my God, this is what I've always wanted. I'm in the girl group, you know, I'm the it girl, which it sounds so silly now because I just don't imagine myself ever going for that goal now. But at the time it was like, you know, it was something that I felt like I'd suddenly ticked that box and got that, you know, social success that I wanted and I craved. And I think ultimately the void that I think it filled was feeling good about myself for the first time in my life. I don't really think I'd felt good about the way I looked or my body because of the environment that I grew up in. And I've had to work so hard now, and I'm sure we'll touch on this, at reframing what beauty is, what a good body is, for example, what health is, all these things that I now know to be so far from where I was. But at the time, that's all I knew. And that's what I went with.
I spent the weekend listening to you, watching you to research for this podcast. And there's one thing you said that really struck me as a sort of really smart and insightful thing. I mean, you said lots of smart and insightful things, but this in particular stayed with me. You said, I lost loads of weight, but what's more important is how I came back from there. And I think that's true of lots of people. Mm. You lose the weight, there's a fanfare, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody tells you you look amazing. Mm. I think what's trickier is not just the physical maintenance, which I know you just mentioned, but where does your mind go from there? Because that's so ephemeral. Mm. That's a sort of, it's like kind of empty calories, if you will. You know, you feel hungry again quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So at what point did you think, actually, this isn't really the right thing for me?
Mm. I have the conversation with a lot of women, and it goes like this. The body that we want is not often the body that we should actually have. Mm-hmm. That's our healthy body. That's our body that allows us to go out on the weekends and have a pizza. That's our body that allows us to have a few glasses of wine on the weekend. My body that I desperately wanted was not the body that I'm allowed to exist in, being happy and healthy. So I had to recalibrate what healthy and normal and balanced was to me and how that looked on my body, because that was not the body that I wanted.
So you can't have the life you want in the body you wanted.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's true of lots of us, right?
Exactly. And this is the thing that I think a lot of women fall into the trap of doing is, and again, I reference the binge restrict cycle, is we constantly feel as though we're not good enough and that the body that we're in is not good enough. So we'll very quickly do things that we think are what we need to do to get to be thinner. And when we do those, we lose a lot of the stuff that's really important in our lives. And going back to what reframing health means to me, social connection is huge for me. Seeing my friends, having a rich social life is so important to my health and well-being. But you can say goodbye to that if you want to be in this body. And so you lose this huge chunk of actually what health means. And you start to peel away, okay, well, I've not really got much energy because I'm not eating very much. So I'm not going to do much exercise, and I'm not going to see my friends because that means eating different foods that I'm not normally going to eat or is going to make me gain weight in brackets. I'm not sleeping very well because I'm waking up hungry. I'm losing all the things that actually mean, you know, make up the equation of health just because I don't want to let myself get away from the body that I think is what I should be in. And I think for me, going back to your question, what was the tipping point? What was the catalyst of being like, this isn't right? It was really having to have a conversation with myself about, what do I want from life? Mm. Do I want to have children? Yeah. Well, you're not having a period at the moment, so there's no way that that's going to happen. Do you want to live to a long age? Yes. Well, you're losing your hair and you're not really very healthy and you're not sleeping and you're stressed as hell. That's not really very conducive to a long, healthy life. You know, do I want to have lots of friends? Yes. Well, you're not really doing that at the moment because you're not even going out and seeing people. You know, all these things started to come up that I was just like really questioning my incentive and what I wanted from life. And it was a real kind of moment of, I'm going to have to grieve letting go of this body and letting go of what I think is good and beautiful and successful if I want even remotely the life that I think I want now. And I think that it was a process of grieving. It was a process of readjusting. You know, every time you look in the mirror, not seeing that six pack, like that's a hard thing to get your head around, but you can do it. Looking in the mirror and maybe seeing things that are, as I would say, you know, like things that maybe you're not 100% comfortable with, but still being okay with it. And it's not that I now look in the mirror and go, oh my God, I love myself, because I really don't practice that way of being. I don't think anyone looks in the mirror every single day and goes, I love myself. I mean, there sure are a few people, but for most of us, the place that we want to get to is neutrality.
Yeah.
That I look in the mirror and say,
acceptance.
This is where I am. And some days I feel better and some days I feel worse. And some days I feel terrible, but I am not going to let it change the fact that I feel good in what I do, that I am practicing healthy behaviors, and that I know in a week's time I'll probably wake up and feel 10 times better. That's basically where I try and get where I've worked to get myself to, where I try and get my audience to get to, is finding neutrality and, as you said, acceptance.
That's quite a huge thing, because it strikes me as you sat down, decided the life you wanted, and realized you couldn't have the body you then wanted and have the life you wanted. But I suppose the big con trick to bust open is that we're taught that the body everyone wants is the life, but it's not the life.
No.
It's just a shape of a body.
Yeah.
And it's not a life in itself.
No. And I made it sound so easy, by the way. It's really not. Like, I've
had of course.
Years of therapy and I've worked so hard. And it is a lifelong journey that I think we are all on. Because the other thing that I think is so important to acknowledge, and I'm really noticing this now, is a woman's body changes so much over their lifetime in a way that a man's doesn't necessarily in the same way.
Over a month.
Yeah, exactly. A month, a week, a year, you know, like whatever. We change, we fluctuate.
Yeah.
We have children. If that's the route you choose to go down, we go through menopause. Like, there are points in a woman's life where she is massively challenged by what's happening to her body.
Yes.
And I think that if you only ever see yourself as being good enough in your size 8 jeans that you wore when you were 22, you are setting yourself up for failure, because unfortunately life doesn't work that way and our bodies don't work that way. And I'm not saying that there aren't still people that probably might be able to do that who are genetically set up for that body shape, but the majority of us will fluctuate, will be bigger, will be smaller, will go through trauma, will lose weight because we're not, do you know what I mean? It's not always that we're just consistent. And I think that the more we can accept that fluctuation and acceptance of where we are, the more that we are creating a safer space for our bodies just to be and to be allowed to be, you know, whatever we are that day.
You touched there on therapy and how that process has been for you. And I know that you've acknowledged rightly that therapy is such a huge privilege that's not accessible to many of us. But I do think your insight of somebody who's having been through therapy is valuable here on the subject of some of the issues you've talked about on your social media accounts, health anxiety and depression. Can you tell me, those subjects are absolutely vast, but can you tell me about the relationship between those challenges and your self-image, if any? We see lots and lots of connections in people who are suffering from mental ill health and how they view themselves, how they treat their appearance and grooming and so on. Has there ever been a correlation or a disconnect for you with those things?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's an absolute given that if you're not mentally feeling 100%, the first thing to go is your self-care, because it's almost a feeling of like you just don't feel worthy of doing that stuff to yourself. It's like, you know, I have times, and I had it not even that long ago, where I just, to even get out of bed was like, what's the point? Do you know what I mean? And it's just, for me, it's definitely massive peaks and troughs. Like, I can have months where I'm absolutely fine and I feel on top of the world and I'm generally a very happy and positive person, so this isn't a kind of consistent thing for me, but I can be hit by what feels like an overbearing weight of either real sadness, like not even sadness isn't even the word, it's like a heaviness that you just can't shift, or anxiety, but beyond just, you know, general worries about stuff. Mine is, I'm dying. I need to go to the hospital now. Like, I really feel like something is seriously wrong with me. And I think I've no idea why those things hit me when they do. And you know, I wish I had the answer or understood that. But I think that you're absolutely right that often the triggers for those things or the warning signs that I'm falling into one of those things is my body image. I start to feel really rubbish about myself. I'm very self-critical. I can really notice myself really stopping bothering doing things like such basic things. And I'm going to be really gross by saying this, but like I'll be lying in bed at night and just be like, I just can't even be bothered to get up and brush my teeth. Mm-hmm. And I would never normally do that, mm-hmm. but it's like that kind of, you just lose the ability to really care for yourself.
Another area in which you have persevered and talked lots about is acne and skin. Mm-hmm. So what has that journey looked like for you? Because you're not on Instagram, you're not just there in Lycra, you're also there in your skin. Uh-huh. And presumably that comes under the same sort of scrutiny as your shape.
Yes, I think weirdly, I probably at times have been more conscious of my skin than my body. And I think it's caused me more distress than my body, which is bizarre because I think, you know, again, I was saying how I've had lifelong issues with my body. But I think what the difficult thing that I really struggled with, and I want to hammer this message home until, you know, whatever. I felt judged massively off the fact that people believe there is a complete correlation between health and skin.
Yes.
I.e. it must be something.
And hygiene.
Yeah. It must be something you're eating.
Yeah.
It must be something you're doing. I would get messages all the time. You need to cut out dairy. You need to not have this. It must be because you're doing this. And I felt...
There is practically, given as somebody who's not a fitness expert, but has worked in skincare for my entire career, there is absolutely no scientific validity to that at all.
Exactly.
In case anyone's listening and is sick to death of people telling them to stop drinking milk or whatever.
And this is the thing that I really found frustrating, Sally, was... I really felt like I therefore had to hide myself because I didn't feel like I was the full package. I didn't have the glowing skin. So therefore, how can I be a health expert?
Right.
Because I didn't present this image of what people believe to be in the picture of health.
Yeah.
And I really struggled with that. And actually, you know, I found my dermatologist who was the first person that said to me, it's not your fault. And I actually think for me, that was huge because I'd seen a lot of like sort of aestheticians and I'd gone to every facialist going and I'd tried every expensive product and nothing was working for me. And I really was, this is me. It's my fault. I'm obviously not doing something right. And when I went to go and see Anjali,
lovely Anjali.
Oh, she's just amazing. And her...
Who suffers from acne herself, which I think is an interesting
and
relevant point.
Yeah, which is why I went to her. Because I thought, I want to go to someone who understands this, not just as a professional, but personally, who understands that feeling of, you know, not quite matching up with what people believe to be the image that you're supposed to portray in your industry.
And we'll put Anjali's details in the show notes, by the way, in case you want to follow her on social or look up her clinic. But she's a terrific dermatologist.
She's just brilliant. And I have to say her bedside manner, she just sat with me, gave me so much kind of reassurance that I wasn't doing anything wrong, that it wasn't my fault and that there were things that I could do that would help. And look, I have gone down the route of going on Roaccutane, which I've taken for the last 5 months. I was given other options and I would highly encourage someone to speak to a dermatologist and assess all of their options and really go through that with them. Because, you know, for me personally, there was lots of options on the table and it was really helpful to sort of look at all of them and go with the one that I felt was best for me. But everyone's going to be different. But I did go down that route. I'm not going to sit here and say Roaccutane is the only way, but I have had the best experience on it. I was really nervous about going on it before. I'd read lots of things that maybe had deterred me from going down that route. But having been on it now for 5 months with minimal to no side effects, an improved mood because I feel so confident and amazing in my skin, incredible results, like night and day results, and a real treatment plan that I feel confident with and supported in. It's the best decision I've ever made. And I have this kind of conversation that I have online that I don't believe that we all have to have this perfect skin to be healthy and to look the part. But I do believe that for me, dealing with my acne was something that I really wanted to do. And I will probably still get breakouts in my future. I'm sure that that's going to be something that will happen. And I'm sure that I'm never going to be someone that has completely perfect skin. But I really felt like I wanted to do something that I knew was, first of all, incredibly well researched and backed by a lot of evidence, and also something that has been proven to improve acne. And in doing that, I really feel that I've explored that option and thankfully had a really great experience, and I'm really happy that I've done it. But going back to what I was saying, I really believe that the two are very separate. Like, dealing with my acne was one thing, but also knowing that skin and the appearance of your skin isn't connected necessarily to, you know, whatever it is that you want to portray in terms of health and well-being. There's just not that correlation. I think people think there is.
Yes. People are very confident in making those statements. Yeah. I do see that a lot. What does the rest of your routine look like? I know that you love beauty. Yes. You are interested in beauty. Yes. Tell me what you like doing for yourself in your beauty routine.
Oh, gosh, so
And
much.
I mean beauty, not health, because I think it's really important to say, I would really like to say, people ask me all the time online, they're like, I've got severe acne, what should I use? Acne is a health condition. Mm. It is not a beauty condition. Mm. It's a health condition. Mm. And requires medical treatment if it is severe. What beauty is the nice stuff, the minor stuff, or the pleasurable stuff. So tell me what that looks like for you.
Yeah, I mean, I love beauty. My gosh, in another life, I love to come back as like a makeup artist or something. So I just love it. But
do you love being made up?
Oh, yeah. Oh my God, to be honest, I love anything that's kind of, I'm like a typical girl's girl, like beauty, makeup, hair, fashion, I just love it all. But I think for me, beauty, I enjoy really kind of like, I've like finding what works for me and really finding my routine with it and trying new products, trying different things. My childhood was spent watching YouTube and trying to recreate makeup videos. I just remember every afternoon coming home from school and like rushing upstairs, putting up, I can't remember the name of the girl that I used to watch that was like amazing, an American girl. And I used to try and copy her beauty routines. But my beauty sort of routine now is very much making my skin look and feel good. I'm all about the base. I love a really nice kind of dewy, healthy base.
Yeah.
And that comes from, and actually one of the things Angela and I were just, the dermatologist was discussing, was having now gone on Roaccutane and having much, you know, kind of improved skin. My routine is so cheap. It's like three steps. I used to, you know, go into Space NK and spend a fortune on every oil and cream and everything, which is great, and I loved it, but I very much stripped it back, and I actually quite like that it's very simple. Mm-hmm. But super nourishing, all about packing moisture, because obviously you're pretty dry when you're on Roaccutane. So I love sort of getting my skin to have a nice base. I love my products that I adore, like the Chanel CC cream. Love. Although I saw that you reviewed the It CC cream that you were talking about when
yes.
you came back from New York.
Yes.
And I was very influenced by you, Sally, trying
gosh.
It, and I loved it. So that's another one that I really like. And then I love a good blush. I think it was you that was saying as well, I have followed you for quite a while, about how a blush can really lift your face. And
I just think blusher makes pretty much everyone look better.
Yeah.
It's not about making you look younger. It's not about making your face look thinner or all that other stuff
yeah.
we get from social media. It just gives you a kind of perk.
Yeah.
It gives you a flush of good health, even if it's a fake one. And it just makes you look happier and healthier and brighter and more cheerful, I always think.
Completely. And I think that when I think back to 16-year-old Alice, who had like a dream matte mousse in her blazer pocket and put it on her lips and all over her face, and I was just one colour. When I discovered, I remember my mum used to say to me, you must like put a bit of colour on your face. You need to use a bit of blush. And I'd be like, no. And then as soon as I discovered it, just being so in awe of the fact that it really does change that. It just gives you that lift. So I love a bit of blush. And if I were to strip my routine back to sort of three things, it would be a good base, a little bit of blush, and a bit of mascara. That's me done.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of that.
I'd be quite similar, I think. What about fragrance?
Ooh, well, I do love fragrance. Again, I get a stick with what I know. I've worn the same fragrance for 2 or 3 years now, and I just love it. So I wear Suntal 33 by Le Labo.
It's a beautiful fragrance.
I just love it. I like quite masculine scents, and I know that that one's a unisex one, and I like the kind of bit of masculine undertone. I don't, when I say masculine, obviously, what does that mean? I think kind of the more oody, sort of woody sense I really like. Whether that's masculine or not, you can decide. But
well, it's just not so sort of overtly feminine, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. I don't like sort of florally perfumes. I like the more kind of oody sense. But I've worn that for like 2+ years and I love it. And I'm really someone who wears fragrance everywhere. If I'm going to the shops, bit of perfume. If I'm going to the gym, bit of perfume.
Would you feel a bit weird
taking the bins out? Bit of perfume. Literally.
I'm so impressed you take the bins out.
Yes, of course. But yeah, I will always have a fragrance on. Even if I haven't got a face on, I'll have a fragrance on.
Skin and Me, our brilliant sponsor here on Beyond the Bathroom, is a subscription skincare service tailored to provide exactly what your skin needs. I can vouch personally for both the service and the treatment because I myself have been a paying Skin and Me subscriber for almost 2 years and I wouldn't be without it. It's a personalised service that's tailored for your skin. Skin and Me treats conditions like acne, rosacea and hyperpigmentation, plus it works on more general skin goals like my own. Greater glow, smoother texture, softer fine lines and wrinkles and more. Each month you'll receive a personalised dermatologist-designed solution packed with powerful, scientifically proven active ingredients you can't buy over the counter. Delivered in a recyclable dispenser called the Daily Doser that you twist and click each night to deliver just the right amount of cream required for a nightly application, making sure that you get the correct dose that won't damage your skin barrier. Because Skin and Me are so confident that you'll love it as much as I do, they're offering all Beyond the Bathroom listeners the opportunity to trial their first month of Skin and Me for just £3.50 instead of at the regular cost of £24.99. That includes all the check-ins you want or need, plus reformulations and advice on tap. Skin and Me want happy, healthy skin for everyone. No dermatologist wait lists required. Just use the code SALLYHUGHES, SALLYHUGHES, at checkout at skinandme.com to redeem the offer. That's SALLYHUGHES at skinandme.com. Just to add to that, if, like Alice, you're living with acne, Skin and Me have helped hundreds of thousands of acne sufferers to clear their spots. So our listener code may prove particularly transformative for your skin. Again, see skinandme.com to see how their dermatologists can help. And when you're not on social media, what do you do for yourself? What little thing do you do for yourself? What we call our Skin and Me moment. What's your happy place?
So mine's a bit of a luxury one.
Yeah.
But I did invest a long time. This was like 2 years ago. I managed to bag myself an LED machine, which is the best thing I've ever done. And I think that I really adore it. It's like my best friend and I love going under there. And
whose LED is it? And we'll pop it in the show notes.
It's from Dermalux. Mm-hmm. So it's like the clinic grade mm-hmm. ones. Again, a very luxury item. So I'm not sitting here saying it's a super accessible one, but there are lots now on the market that are much more of an accessible price range.
Like any tech thing, the price has started to come down as the markets become more flooded.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what I love about it is, one, it makes me feel so good. You know, there's that thing that you do for yourself where I come out and I'm like, oh, I feel amazing. But two, I cannot do anything but lie under it. I can't be on my phone. I can't faff around doing anything. So I do my meditation under there. So it's almost a double-edged thing, is that I lie there, I have this red, I use red, white and blue, if that means anything,
yes.
People know about LED. But I also am able to very much check in with my breath, do my meditation, take 20 minutes, move on with my day. And it's like that little bit of time to myself just to completely zone out. And then I can get back on with the rest of my day. So it's a bit of a luxury one, but it is such a good little tool.
Yes, any moment that restricts you physically from kind of engaging in displacement activity is a good thing, right?
Definitely.
Any disasters with your beauty? Any haircuts you want to forget that I'm now going to make you drag?
I mean,
one of the archives.
Yeah, the Dream Matte Mousse was a real moment for me. I really, it was the Dream Matte Mousse on the lips, which I'm sure some people listening will remember. It was a real thing while I was at school, was everyone had a pot of Dream Matte Mousse and would put it on their lips. So bizarre. I don't know why we did that, but
I mean, I could talk all day about Dream Mat. Such an iconic product.
It
because
really was.
Although we kind of laugh about it now, for a good few years, that was literally the only foundation available to girls of colour.
But also that was like such an amazing price point. Like when I was.
I mean, girls with money, girls of colour who had money could get MAC or whatever. But schoolgirls,
yeah, exactly.
Of colour who had a Boots or a Superdrug or whatever. That was it. Yeah. Dream Mat. There was nothing else.
I mean, thank God for Fenty and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, back in the day, it must have been awful. But Dream Mat Mousse was iconic. It was, is it still around?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh my word, it's so popular still, I think.
Is it? Mm. Okay, well, I'm going to have to go and like get a Dream Mat Mousse as a kind of
It's kind of a rite of passage,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to have to buy one after this. Apart from that, yes, I had some horrendous moments in my kind of beauty journey. I really feel like I found my flow in the last sort of 2 years. But leading up to this, I've definitely done, I cut a fringe. That was horrendous.
Yourself?
No, I didn't cut it myself, but I trimmed it myself and it sort of just got shorter and shorter as I thought that it was growing, but it wasn't really growing. The other thing, I mean, everyone's probably done this, the sun in that made my hair go yellow and fall out.
Absolutely.
But I think that the thing that I actually really like about myself, that it's not beauty disasters or fashion disaster or anything, but I've always not been afraid to, oh, I've never been afraid, sorry, to experiment. I really like, I've always sort of tried new things, you know, saying that I practiced YouTube tutorials and stuff. I'd always try different things. And I think that's why I found my groove now with my beauty routine and with my hair and fashion and all that, is because I've always experimented quite well. I've never been afraid to try different things or colours or whatever, and looks. And I've liked that I've had that kind of adventurousness in me.
I wanted to talk to you about that because I wonder how free you've always been to do that. As I mentioned at the top, you're an ambassador for Women's Aid. Mm. I know that you're extremely passionate about it. Mm. And it's a matter of public record that you're passionate about it because when you were a very young girl, 16 or so, you were in an abusive, physically and mentally mm-hmm. abusive relationship mm-hmm. that resulted in a conviction,
yeah.
in fact,
yeah.
in a court. One thing that lots of people listening will know about controlling and abusive relationships, and you will know either from personal experience or from your role at Women's Aid, that a very common thread throughout those relationships is men who exercise or attempt to exercise control over a woman's appearance, mm-hmm. how she expresses herself with clothing, makeup, hair, self-care, grooming, and so on. Could you talk to me, as much as you feel comfortable mm-hmm. talking about, how that may be manifested for you? Did it, didn't it? Or what you've seen through your work latterly?
Yeah, definitely. I think that my experience, it's so interesting because, as you referenced, I was so young. There's things that I'm only conscious of now that at the time I never saw as being part of the control and the abuse. So I was very aware that physical abuse was wrong. That was a whole nother thing. And I still felt very trapped that I couldn't get away from that. But there was lots of more insidious behaviors.
Right.
That I was never really at the time conscious that those were things that were really quite damaging and abusive. So one of them being not looking appealing to other men.
Yes.
Very consciously
extremely common.
Yeah. Not wanting to attract any attention, to look overtly kind of sexual or, you know, even just pretty, like, you know, just not feeling as though I could really do those things because of the ramifications of what that would therefore mean, you know, if anyone so much as looked at me or talked to me, whatever.
And would you be blamed for that? If someone saw you as attractive, would that be your fault?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And, you know, I distinctly remember a really horrible experience where we've spoken a lot about that. I was into dancing, musical theatre. I went on a summer school. This was age 16. So I was like, you know, a young adult, I would say. I was 16. Going on this summer school, and he went onto my Facebook and saw on my Facebook that I was tagged in photos from mm-hmm. the summer school with other boys. Mm-hmm. Not with them, not talking to them, not near them, but there
classmates,
were other boys.
Fellow
exactly.
students.
Exactly. Yep. And he lost it. Like, absolutely lost it. And I remember the terrifying feeling of just trying to placate the fact that I'd just be like, I'm so, like, you know, it was all my fault, first of all, because I hadn't said that there were going to be boys there. And just the ludicrousy of it, that I had to make him feel better about the fact that I was going to a musical theatre summer school and there were other boys there. You know, it was just so crazy. But at the time, and this is where I think, you know, with hindsight, you're able to view these things so differently. At the time, I remember feeling as it was all my fault. Oh my God, I can't believe I've done this. I feel so bad. You know, making sure that every time I went to the summer school, telling him, I'm not wearing any makeup. I'm dressing like this. I'm not doing my hair. And just feeling as though I was constantly in a state of making sure he was okay. It was never about me. I was never, am I okay? Am I happy? Am I, you know, even, you know, remotely okay? No, I didn't think about that. It was all, is he okay? Is he going to be okay? Every single thing that I ever did was second guessed by the fact that I had to make sure that it would not be something that would upset him.
It's that constant shrinking and shape-shifting, isn't
Completely.
It? Which is ultimately futile because it's not possible to ever shrink and shape-shift, even if it were desirable, which it isn't, to satisfy that person because control is this ever-shifting. It gets tighter and tighter and tighter around you.
That's what I was going to say. I honestly believe that if it wasn't that, it would have been something else. He would always have found something. He was incredibly paranoid and controlling, and it just manifested in so many different ways. And you know, I think a lot of women relate to the fact, and with my work with Women's Aid, who I have to say, like, they are the most phenomenal charity. I know that you and I have both worked with them, and I think a lot of people think that they're this big organization with hundreds of workers. They are a very small team, chronically underfunded, who do life-saving work. And I hear from women, in fact, I got a message from a woman yesterday who had left a horrifically abusive relationship and credited both Women's Aid and myself for giving her the confidence to leave. So they really do save people's lives. But it's only through my work with them that I'm now able to realize not how bad, but just how trapped I was and how helpless I was, and really how I don't think I would have got out of my situation had what happened not happened. I don't think I would have got out of it, probably not for a long time, because I couldn't. And it turns into this horrible cycle of you desperately want to leave, but if you try to leave, they tighten their grip. So then you're pulled in further, and then you try to leave and they tighten their grip. And it gets to the point where you're so fearful of literally even breathing that you are just a shell of yourself.
And so what happened was your hand was forced effectively because there was an episode in a public place at your school.
Yeah.
And so some action absolutely had to occur because he and you were on school property when a physical attack occurred. And you ended up in court. And I wonder, with it's so far behind you in terms of years, and you are now in a respectful, loving relationship with yourself as well as with a new partner. Do you like yourself better? Has Alice recovered from that? Do you like who you see when you look in the mirror, or do you believe some of what you heard back then?
The worst moment of my life would have been that attack. I think that the feeling that you feel more than any other in an abusive relationship, I felt, was shame. And that moment where he attacked me in front of my school friends, in a public place, what had been a very closed experience, no one had ever really seen it. And much of domestic abuse cases occur completely behind closed doors. So it's very one word against another. The fact that that happened in a public place, in front of people, first of all, the thing that terrifies me to this day about that experience was, if I hadn't have pressed charges, I believe that that would have got worse. There's very much attacking someone and punching them in the face in public. I feel that if that had happened and I hadn't done anything, what would be the next step?
It always gets worse.
Exactly.
It only ever goes in one direction.
And I think that that really scares me and makes me so grateful at the same time for the fact that I was thankfully safeguarded really well by my school, who were absolutely adamant that I rung the police and I pressed charges. And if it hadn't have been for them giving me the confidence to do that and my mum, I would have never have got that conviction and the restraining order that I got, which made me feel a tiny bit safer. I still to this day have moments where I feel incredibly unsafe. For example, sometimes I'll walk out my front door and just have this like complete panic that he's going to be there or like round the corner. And what would he do? Because I decided to talk about this stuff publicly about 3 or 4 years ago. it's that fear that suddenly he's going to hear something or see something and just lose it. And I know that he would have the capacity to do that. But, you know, I just believe that if I didn't talk about this stuff, I wouldn't have, you know, like I referenced earlier about having a woman message me, the positives have far outweighed those small feelings every now and then of fear, because the change that I've been able to bring about. And, you know, I spoke in Parliament with Mel B from Spice Girls. I've done so many amazing things with Women's Aid that outweighs all of that stuff. In response to your question about whether I like myself, it kind of brings all that together in that I still have moments where I can feel very guarded and very closed because of my experience, and I'm very able to retreat into myself and feel very scared by what happened to me. But for the majority of the time, and through the work that I've done on myself, I feel I've come so far from that person as well. I feel like I can look back on her and see her, but I feel so far from her, as in there's just the growth of compassion, self-love, being in a really healthy relationship and truly understanding what respect and love really mean, being supported by my friends and family and having open communication with them. The worst thing that I did in our relationship was in the relationship I was in was to not tell anyone because I was so ashamed. But, you know, now I'm able to very much communicate with my friends, with my family. So really, I feel so far from her. But at the same time, there are still these moments where I just can be right back there, which I think anyone who's been in an abusive relationship will feel. You can just have these moments where you're right back there and you feel every single feeling that you went through, and then you very quickly come out of it.
You've been so public. I said at the top that you've been so public and open about how your perspective on all sorts of things has shifted. Your perspective on how your career began, the gear change you decided on, all sorts of things. I think it's such an admirable quality. And I wonder what that process has been for you. I always think, you know, there's nothing worse than somebody who's exactly the same person throughout their entire lives. Nothing worse than that.
No.
How has it been doing that changing, that maturing, that shifting publicly? And has that been instrumental in showing you a different way, I suppose?
Yeah, I think that having a public profile from such a young age, so I started when I was about 21.
Yeah, you grew up in public.
Yeah, basically, I think that I've made a hell of a lot of mistakes. And I think the thing that has always served me and helped me to grow is that I've never been afraid to hold my hands up and say I've made a mistake. And I think owning your, I'm going to call them failures, although I don't necessarily see them in such a negative connotation. Owning your mistakes, owning the things that haven't necessarily gone right for you, is the only way to get better as a person and to improve. We are none of us faultless. We are all fallible. We will all make mistakes. There are so many things I've done in the last 10 years. I actually feel very kind of reflective at the moment because I turned 30 in February, and it's like been a big thing for me to have these 10 years in the public eye, and kind of, I say in the public eye, not necessarily completely, but, you know, to be 10 years online and to be really looking back and seeing what I've done over the last 10 years, it feels really emotional for me. And I think that why I think I've maybe lasted and been able to continue evolving is because I'm not someone who will ever sit back and sit still and just be like, I'm done, I've made it, I'm a good person, you know, whatever. I always want to be better and always know I can be better. I can always be more aware about things, be more conscious about those who I might not necessarily think about first, you know, be really just trying to be better every day. And it doesn't have to be big things. It's sometimes the smallest of things, but just trying to be better every day and never just sitting still and sitting back and thinking I've made it. And the biggest thing is owning my flaws and owning my mistakes. Do I think that what I did with Clean Eating Alice was right? No. Does that mean I'm going to sit here and hate on everything that I did? No. Do I think that I've learned so much from every single thing that's happened to me that I've done? Yes. And I feel so grateful that I've got an audience of people who have allowed me to slip up, to do things that they wouldn't necessarily do now, and to own those things, but be able to move forward and say, this is what I thought then, this is what I think now, this is why I've made this decision to change, I'm really grateful for you, with you for you know, really grateful for you coming along with me for the journey.
Wait till you're 40. It's the mother load of audits. When you turn 40, you have a major audit.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, it's, well, if you're doing it right, you have a major
but
audit.
But you
yeah.
think as well, I feel so excited about that process.
Absolutely.
I really feel that I follow people online who make me excited about getting older. And that's been a big shift that I've had in the last sort of few years, is that 30 feels on the horizon. Sure, okay, it's not that old, and I'm not saying it is, but it feels like a gear shift for me in terms mm-hmm. of where you go with your mm-hmm. life. And I think that I really feel grateful that I follow people who really make me excited about every age. I follow people in, there's an amazing page called Gorgeous 50s. Do you follow her?
No.
Oh my God, she's amazing.
I will find out though.
But just every stage of life, seeing people who are at different stages to me. I don't just follow young, cool, you know, so-and-sos. I follow a real spectrum of people, and it makes me excited about different stages of my life and what's to come. And I think that I've been very reflective on the last 10 years, but also very excited about the process of, like you said, kind of going through that audit process and weeding out things that don't serve you and kind of moving forwards with a fresh perspective.
That's it for this episode. Thank you so much to the wonderful Alice Living for putting her best face forward so frankly and honestly. Please subscribe and follow to Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a rating and a review. I'll see you next time with my next guest. Bye.
Insanity Group.